Hello, and welcome to episode number 96 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. While the notion of extraterrestrial life has long captivated the public imagination, certain expectations regarding how such life might interact with us have also proven problematic. Primarily, that's because being the stubborn species we are, when data doesn't conform to our expectations, we tend to either ignore it, explain it away, or assume it has been gathered incorrectly, or is even the result of fraudulent reporting. This issue has been paramount in the matter of the modern UFO phenomenon, because many elements of the reports that have arisen from eyewitness testimony contain elements that stretch our expectations, often to the breaking point and beyond. A term that has been put forward to explain the various elements that stretch our expectations of how sophisticated non-terrestrial intelligence would interact with us, even to the point of defying rational understanding altogether, is high strangeness. Here we see crossover into another domain, that of general paranormality. Now, while we modern Westerners would like to keep these bodies of data completely separate, after all, why would extraterrestrials act in ways that are reminiscent of apparitions and poltergeist phenomena, or so the conventional thinking goes, the reality is that these two kinds of data seem to regularly co-arise in people's experience. And that being the case, it would be unwise to let our pre-existing biases prevent us from seeing linkages that clearly exist in the raw data itself. Speaking of crossover between domains that tend to be kept distinct in our modern notions of how reality works, we also see startling parallels between the UFO phenomenon and humanity's most ancient expressions of religion, collectively referred to as shamanism. The most glaring similarities arise in the experience of reality people report in both shamanistic journeys and encounters with supposed aliens, quote-unquote, during contact experiences reported as part of the modern UFO phenomenon. In both cases, people report experiencing the encounter in a seemingly alternate realm or non-ordinary state of consciousness. The question that emerges, pertaining to the UFO phenomenon, if these really are space aliens, quote-unquote, that is, physical beings arising from some distant star system, then why would the encounters involve so much overlap with the vision quest encounters reported in shamanism? While one can certainly attempt to explain away these parallels in the bodies of data, a more open-minded, objective, and sincere perspective might very well land on the notion that these clues are telling us something fundamental about the nature of reality itself, something that seems to inevitably lead towards a reframing of what it means to be a sentient life form living in a supposedly, quote-unquote, physical universe, as defined under the dictates of scientific materialism. But what precisely is the nature of the overlap between domain/topics such as shamanism and experiences that fall within the modern UFO phenomenon, and where might the implications of these alignments lead us? These are the mind-stretching and paradigm-collapsing matters we'll seek to delve more deeply into in this, the 96th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's episode, I would just like to remind everyone that if you'd like to support this podcast, and in so doing also gain access to all of my content, which includes not just Point of Convergence and Liminal Frames, but also OTC Squared and various feature series, as well as gaining access to my private Discord server, as well as a new feature that kicks off next week, that being a live Q&A session that will happen regularly, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/exoacademian or by becoming a subscriber on Spotify. All right, with that preamble aside, let's move into this week's topic. In this week's episode, we're going to look into the parallels between shamanism, again, humanity's most ancient form of religion, and encounters had within the modern UFO phenomenon. Why would this parallel exist, and what might it be saying to us about the nature of ultimate reality? As we kick off here, I'd also like to give my usual disclaimer that I think that what we referred to as the modern UFO phenomenon actually entails different kinds of beings arising from different kinds of origin sources altogether. Again, I think we do a disservice to the data and to our quest to understand what's going on by collapsing it all or trying to find one meta pattern within all of the data. I think, again, we have different kinds of beings from different kinds of origins interacting with us, and we're better served by looking for individual patterns within the totality to try to identify these different kinds of interactions. Certainly, some kinds of interactions seem more technological in nature, while others seem to be more like mystical experiences described in ancient shamanistic traditions and other religious traditions as well. But again, sometimes that distinction is not so easy to delineate. And ultimately, if reality is mentational in nature, in other words, if idealism is a better description as a model of ultimate reality than physicalism, which I think is almost certainly the case, really at this point, physicalism is not just unsupported by the data, but largely untenable, then really hardline distinctions between the technological and the mystical are misguided, to say the least. And I think much of the material we get into today will demonstrate that. So let's get into it. We're going to be talking about the crossover between encounters had within shamanism and encounters had within the UFO phenomenon. Again, this has a lot to do with cultural expectations, cultural framing. In the modern West, we're going to assume some sort of encounter with some kind of other has to be something perhaps extraterrestrial, because that is the last frontier to be explored, or so the modern conventional paradigm would suggest. But again, the point here is if that paradigm is misguided, woefully misguided, completely barking up the wrong tree, as it were, then really these distinctions disappear, and even these expectations around what the remaining frontiers to be explored are also significantly change. Now, regarding this issue of the remaining frontiers to be explored, a term that has been bandied about more recently in the UFO phenomenon community is that of interdimensionals as opposed to extraterrestrials. This speaks to perhaps the idea of parallel universes, but often the term is used in a kind of broad way to describe things we just don't understand yet. In other words, it's more that the evidence doesn't seem to be supporting the notion that these are just extraterrestrials as we would expect them to be, although again, that might be part of it. But really, when we use this term interdimensional, we're allowing for something beyond what we would expect, something that stretches our paradigms of what is possible and what the various origin source possibilities could be. And this led me to post a following on social media recently. I said, quote, "When we say interdimensional, we really still have no idea how to map that to conventional models with specificity. The term is becoming a placeholder for, quote, something we don't understand yet, unquote. Don't mistake the regular use of a term for a truly comprehensive understanding of what it ultimately points to, unquote." And that's the key here. Again, according to how far we're willing to stretch our imagination in conventional circles, a term like interdimensional gets introduced, and even people like Jacques Vallée introduced this back in the 1970s, because those notions were emerging in science, that there could be frontiers beyond just the broad expanse of our physical universe. But again, the point I want to drive home here is that really this term, as it's being used right now in the public and even by some of our Congress people who are trying to investigate this matter, is more like a placeholder. There's no specificity about what this refers to. It's just saying that the usual players in terms of the possibilities don't seem adequate, don't seem sufficient as we learn more about this phenomenon. And that in itself is really interesting and I think serves as a kind of middle point in our march towards better understanding around what this means. All that is to say, we are still in the process of gathering data and considering how that data would impact our underlying model of reality. That's where we should be. That's really where we are, if we're honest right now, in our process. Now again, today we're going to be thinking about shamanism and its overlap with the modern UFO phenomenon. And here again, we're reminded of what we discussed last time, namely that common contact across time may have been missed because of language/cultural framing differences. And again, really when we get past the language and the surface veneer, we see remarkable overlap in these different kinds of traditions that describe perhaps the same kinds of encounters in very different ways. Now, for those of you that tuned into the last episode, episode 95, And if you haven't listened to that, I would suggest perhaps you listen to that before this episode, because they kind of dovetail together. We drew largely from a book titled Secret Machines, Gods, Volume 1 of the Gods, Man, and War Trilogy by Peter Levende and Tom DeLonge. We're going to be drawing from that book again, as well as even more primarily from a book titled Shamanism and Alien Abductions, A Comparative Study by Simon Brian Harvey Wilson. And this was actually a thesis that he put together as part of his postgraduate program. And it's one of the most comprehensive comparisons between shamanism and the modern UFO phenomenon that currently exists. Let's now jump into a section from Secret Machines, Gods, Volume 1 of Gods, Man, and War, to discuss how shamanism plays in here. Quote, is there any substantive difference between the two from the point of view of consciousness? In other words, did the ancient peoples perceive a humanoid presence associated with aerial phenomena in a way that is close to us moderns? And this phenomenon partakes of effects that are psychological, we might say parapsychological, in terms that are better described using the vocabulary of religion and mysticism. We are confronted with the possibility that persons within different cultural contexts will perceive it differently and may see the phenomenon manifesting in different ways, or at least interpret it according to a vocabulary available to them, which, ironically, would be misinterpreted by later commentators in light of their own understanding of the terms. From what we know of shamanism, particularly those forms for which we have more recent information from anthropologists and travelers in the 19th and 20th centuries, contact with spiritual forces is an integral part of the practice, as is the experience of flight. This flight might take place to celestial regions, but can just as easily take place to underworld regions, quote-unquote, i.e. below the earth, unquote. Now, I just want to draw your attention to that key point being made by Levende and DeLonge in this book, in that section we just read from. They are saying that because language and cultural differences frame these matters differently, ways that this was described in the ancient past might be missed in terms of being recognized as being part and parcel with the modern UFO phenomenon, because those descriptions alone distract us from the underlying reality, and that because we have our own modern mythos by which we describe these kinds of contact experiences, we are talking about two different kinds of vocabulary, two completely different frames of reference, and it's those different frames of reference that cloud this reality from being seen as it really is. That is to say, we miss the fact that underlyingly we're talking about mystical contact, contact that seems to happen again in an alternate state of consciousness or an alternate realm very often, both for experiencers of the modern UFO phenomenon as well as these ancient encounters described in shamanism. Now, before we proceed any further, for those of you who might not be so familiar with shamanism, let's begin with this quick overview. A shaman is typically defined as a spiritual and ceremonial practitioner who is believed to have the ability to connect with the spirit world in order to heal, receive guidance, and commune with spiritual entities. The practice of shamanism is found in various cultures around the world, although specific beliefs and practices can vary widely. Key characteristics and roles associated with shamans include, number one, spiritual intermediary. Shamans are often considered intermediaries between the human and spirit realms. They may communicate with spirits, deities, or other supernatural beings on behalf of their community. And here I would ask you to consider different well-known experiencers in modern times who serve also as kind of intermediaries between these others, who are giving warnings to our civilization very often, by the way, which is also similar to shamanism, and these more ancient encounters described in shamanism. Okay, getting back to the description of a shaman, number two, a healer. Shamans are frequently recognized for their healing abilities. This can involve physical, emotional, and spiritual healing. Rituals, ceremonies, and the use of herbs or other traditional methods may be employed in the healing process. Now, again, I want to point you to someone like Chris Bledsoe, who, after his encounters, seemed to have healing powers. And many people around the world have written him, even sent him pieces of clothing and whatnot, or pictures, so he could pray for them, because he seemingly has these powers only after having encountered these others in this kind of other realm. Again, think about the parallels here in how shamans are described often as healers. Number three, ceremonial leader. Shamans often lead rituals and ceremonies that are central to the spiritual and social life of their community. These ceremonies may involve music, dance, chanting, and the use of sacred objects. Now, again, here we're speaking of kinds of technologies, different protocols that are used to make these connections with these various others. Think about how we do that with the modern UFO phenomenon. Think about the protocols put forward in CE5 or HICE, human-initiated contact experiences. Think about how that also is a kind of ceremonial procedure leading to contact. Number four, divination. Shamans may practice divination to gain insights into the future, receive guidance, or understand the cause of current issues. Divination methods can include the interpretation of dreams, reading of signs in nature, or using specific tools like bones, stones, or cards. Now, here I will remind you of the many occasions where we've talked about the convergence between the UFO phenomenon and phenomena such as near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences. Now, I've discussed in the past someone named Elizabeth Crone, who had a near-death experience after being struck by lightning. Now, after her journey into a kind of other world, you could argue, she kind of perceived that she was in her understanding of what heaven might be like. But importantly, after she came back, she had developed precognitive dreaming capabilities. She would dream about the future, and this would be demonstrable, things like plane crashes and whatnot. Again, think about how that mirrors what shamans would encounter after having crossed over into these other realms and then coming back with information that would help the tribe, etc. Next, we have soul retrieval. In some shamanic traditions, it is believed that illness or spiritual imbalance can result from the loss of a person's soul. Shamans may engage in soul retrieval rituals to bring back lost aspects of a person's soul. Again, this really comes down to a kind of translation to some sort of energetic process. Energy is central to this entire matter, again, something I teach regularly in Essence of Being. Keep this in mind. Look past the language and think about the underlying realities being described here. Next, we have ecstatic experiences. Shamans often enter altered states of consciousness through various means, such as drumming, chanting, dancing, or the use of hallucinogenic substances. These altered states are thought to facilitate communication with the spirit world. Again, think again about CE5 or HICE protocols. Think again about how this is about using various protocols to journey to these other kinds of realms or to enter into these other kinds of states of consciousness where contact with these other kinds of beings exist. Again, in an overarching sense, consider the notion of idealism. Consider that perhaps what we have here are not different realms of reality so much as overlapping and interpenetrating dreamscapes, and that these different protocols allow us to move beyond our usual parameters of physical, quote-unquote, reality, and interact with these different kinds of dreamscapes. Again, the notion here is that all these different realms are actually dreamscapes, perhaps held in the mind of God, or as Bernardo Castro calls it, mind at large. Now, there do exist other parallels between ancient shamanic traditions and the modern UFO phenomenon. One of these is that in these ancient traditions, shamans often came from the same family. In other words, there was this generational continuation of shamanistic capacity. So again, the key here is that these people are not just picked at random from the population. They have specific giftings, perhaps because they've already journeyed into another realm, or perhaps because they have it in their genetic makeup, or whatever the underlying energetic configuration that gets expressed as genetic makeup would suggest. Again, what's interesting is that we have multiple generations of abductees in the modern UFO phenomenon, and in these ancient traditions, we have this continuation across this genetic line of shamanistic capabilities. That is, an ability to see beyond the usual parameters of physical reality and our usual sense perceptions. Now, one key distinction sociologically in terms of how these people are regarded, in these ancient traditions, shamans were recognized as key leaders, as people that helped the tribe, that helped to bring back key messages from these other realms to help them, to help the entire community moving forward. But of course, that's not at all how experiencers have been treated by modern society. And this is spoken to, again, in this book, Shamanism and Alien Abductions, a Comparative Study by Simon Brian Harvey Wilson. Quoting again from that book, quote, "The shamans are expected to undergo appropriate training to become otherworld travelers or living connections between the spirit realm and normal reality. Although sometimes dangerous, their role is a valued one, and shamans with powerful healing abilities are highly prized. In social terms, their work has a recognized and productive function. On the other hand, in Western societies, people who think they have been abducted by aliens have been regarded as suffering from some form of personality defect or mental illness, although that may now be changing slightly as the subject becomes more widely publicized. Many abductees nevertheless prefer to remain anonymous, although a small number integrate their experiences in a positive fashion and are able to publicize them with few ill effects." Unquote. Now, that section right there spoke to the different sociological embrace of shamans versus modern experiencers. Again, we're entertaining the idea here that at least some experiencers represent the same kind of function that shamans served in ancient traditions, even though they are not greeted with the same kind of respect and admiration. Now, of course, this speaks to different cultural framings. Now, interestingly, this week I had a conversation with someone in a meeting where they described actually being the person who had a conversation with John Mack back in the day and first suggested to him that he look into encounters described in indigenous traditions that mirrored much of the modern UFO phenomenon. And up until this point, no one had made this connection. At least very few had made the connection, and it wasn't widely known. But this person suggested to John that he go speak to Native Americans, different indigenous cultures around the world, and learn that actually this is a common part of their understanding, that they've been interacting with these beings all along. And because their mythos doesn't reject such notions, and there's more of an openness to the notion of different realms, they actually have this as part of their social fabric. And again, it's recognized, admired, certainly valuable, and quote-unquote normal. Let's now jump into another section from the same book, this comparative study between shamanism and the UFO phenomenon. Quote, "Shamanism is thought to have originated in Siberia and Central Asia, but the term is now used to refer to similar practices in many parts of the world, such as the Amazon Basin, North America, Oceania, and Africa. It is believed that shamanism is the oldest form of religious activity, with evidence dating back thousands of years, such as cave paintings and carvings of people dressed in animal skins resembling outfits still used by some shamans today." Joan Halifax writes that, quote, "A common thread seems to connect all shamans across the planet, an awakening to other orders of reality, the experience of ecstasy, and an opening up of visionary realms from the essence of the shamanic mission," unquote. Continuing, quote, "The traditional shaman may simultaneously be the local healer, social worker, clairvoyant, and magician, as well as guardian, and to a certain extent, creator, of a tribe's mythology. Most of these skills derive from shamans' ability to enter what they believe is the spirit world via trance or altered state of consciousness, often induced by drumming. The cultural beliefs in shamanistic societies all over the world that support this behavior are that a spirit world does exist, that shamans can liaise between it and normal reality, and that it is inhabited by spirits who will help heal various sicknesses at the shaman's bidding. That these beliefs do exist is not disputed by most anthropologists who study shamanism. It is important to emphasize that, having documented the similarities in shamanistic behavior around the world, most anthropologists now believe that all shamans are following the same set of core beliefs with local cultural variations. As Narby points out, it was Mircea Eliade, in his classic book Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy, who identified astonishing similarities in the practices and concepts of shamans the world over. Wherever these technicians of ecstasy operate, they specialize in a trance during which the soul is believed to leave the body and ascend to the sky or descend to the underworld. They all speak a secret language which they learn directly from the spirits by imitation. They consider these spirits to have come from the sky and to have created life on earth." Unquote. Now again, I want to remind you of our conversation last time, talking about different religious groups and how they also had this notion, and how we also see in various religious traditions around the world, Sumerian, Akkadian, Babylonian, etc., these different kinds of practices and understandings and symbology that they all shared in common, even though they were existing on different parts of the planet and therefore weren't influencing each other. And that, of course, prompts the question, how then did these similarities arise, these parallels? Again, one could make the argument, a very strong argument, that it's because of these encounters with beings in other realms that they learn these kinds of traditions, these kinds of teachings, this kind of symbology. And that's why we see it represented across the planet, even around groups that are diverse in terms of their cultural background, their geographic background, etc. This again speaks to the validity of this, the veracity of this, that really these are real encounters had with real beings. And again, this raises interesting questions about ontology, but again, even more so, questions about the nature of reality itself. Now, another parallel that exists between ancient shamanism, as well as the more modern UFO phenomenon, is the way that the people who encounter these kinds of others and these other realms of existence come back transformed. And I mean permanently transformed. They have different views on reality itself and their relationship with other people, the planet, and the surrounding cosmic community. This is spoken to also in this book. Quote, Joan Halifax describes the feeling that shamans have to educate those around them. The impulse to see and describe the structure of the cosmos everywhere exists for those people whose psyches have been open to the experience of non-ordinary realities. However, the interview participants also pointed out that there was a delicate balance between feeling that one has a role to play in teaching about a different perspective on reality and feeling overwhelmed about the enormity of the task after realizing that so many people simply do not see things that way. As Lawrence puts it, quote, most people are still asleep, unquote. This also means that many abductees have a limited circle of friends because, as Helen laments, a lot of people still look at you as if you are a nutter. Similarly, Angela says that most of us are asleep according to them, the aliens, and we need to wake up, so they are assisting. She further explains that understanding my new experiences and being able to integrate them has been a really big challenge. And it can be difficult because you know there is society saying, okay, the physical is real and the other stuff isn't. So that has been a challenge to find a balance and be able to live in both at once. Patricia too describes the enormous challenges of integrating her new expanded perspective into her daily life. I have absolutely changed every facet of who I am through these experiences. So the type of people I relate to are very different. I have now a very different view of life. She also describes how sometimes she feels so frustrated with having to be different and having to carry a sense of responsibility and knowing that things are not right here and that we need to fix them. In a similar vein, Lawrence adds that sometimes it can be a little bit sad because you realize that you can see perhaps a different way of living than other people, but they're not really concerned because they're ignorant. Karen feels the isolation of her position. It is very hard to relate to other people who do not see the world like that. That would be the main thing that I have found very difficult, the isolation created by having that different perspective. On the other hand, Nancy, who has a supportive husband and children who are being abducted, relates how her experiences have expanded her worldview to the extent that she now believes that anything is possible, absolutely anything, even magic. Harner, 1990, expresses sympathy for those that encounter problems convincing others about their shamanic experiences. The persons most prejudiced against the concept of non-ordinary reality are those who have never experienced it. This might be termed cognoscentrism, the analog in consciousness of ethnocentrism, unquote. And the key point here is that these experiencers have much in common with shamanic tradition and how they see things differently, how they have a different understanding of how we should live after having these encounters with these various others in these other realms of reality. A little earlier, I described the experience of Elizabeth Crone, who had a near-death experience while walking into a synagogue in Houston when she was struck by lightning. And afterwards, she had different capabilities that came online because of her experience. Again, after having this experience in what she perceived as a kind of heaven, the key point here being that it was after that experience in that alternate realm or that alternate state of consciousness. Again, we struggle to find the right language here. But regardless, in that non-ordinary, quote-unquote, state experience, she obtained information or capacities, was changed in some fundamental way, so that when she returned to this world, quote-unquote, she had capacities like precognitive understanding. She would often dream the future, again, as I mentioned earlier. Interestingly, this is a very common aspect of shamanistic encounters. Now, in previous episodes, we've discussed at length the Free Foundation data in terms of the Dr. Edgar Mitchell Free Foundation and how they looked into the commonalities, the parallels between different kinds of what they call contact modalities, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, contact with apparitions, contact with seemingly alien beings, the sighting of UFOs, etc. Many times these experiences had this one thing in common, that afterwards these people had different capacities than the rest of the population, capacities that would fall under extrasensory perception. The book also speaks to this, and let's get into that section now. Quote, to assess the degree to which they had been spiritually transformed by their experiences, the interview participants were asked whether they could now sense invisible energies or alien or spiritual entities. Such a skill is an essential part of shamanism. For example, Eliad notes the extreme importance of spirit visions in all varieties of shamanistic initiations. Seeing a spirit, either in dream or awake, is a certain sign that one has in some sort obtained a spiritual condition, that is, that one has transcended the profane condition of humanity. Angela claims that some of the aliens are always around, even though they're not in physical form. I still perceive them and I can hear them speaking, telepathically. So there is a communication happening all the time. In her healing work, Cheryl can sense the presence of entities from her physical reactions, like the goosebumps, like the hair on the back of your neck standing up, that sort of thing. But it's also more of a sense of knowing. Amusingly, she also reports that some of her clients unknowingly bring various entities with them. I have a full house sometimes. Sometimes I have one person in a chair in a room full of onlookers, an audience. Betty can feel entities around her, which she feels may be there just to observe. She also reports that they can appear sometimes at the corner of the eye, like a shadow. Another physical symptom can be a temperature change in myself. My body heat will go up. And if it's a negative sensation, my body temperature can go down. Helen, whose partner has also had abduction experiences, can also feel the presence of invisible entities. The other week, we did a healing on a friend, and we went into her bedroom, and the air was very dense, thick. And when we found where the energy source was, it was very clammy and wet. Nancy knows when there's another interdimensional being around, or spirit person, and Karen can sense the presence of entities in my everyday environment, but does not often see them. However, if I was reading any extraterrestrial-type books, I feel a lot of presences. On those occasions, Karen believes that they are there almost reaffirming what I'm reading. Ruth sometimes paints the various beings that she senses around the house. They seem to like being drawn and painted, so much so that sometimes they tell me to go get a pen and pencil. Unquote. Now, as a couple of parallels here, I'd also like to point out that I've also had these kinds of experiences. In a previous episode, I mentioned seeing kind of shadow beings and sometimes seeing things out of the corner of my eye. This is very much what's been described here as well. And like this situation here where they're talking about books and how there's kind of this encouragement or certain kinds of investigations or certain angles of pursuit, I also very much feel that as well. That's part of my experience and often informs the various subject matter that I end up investigating and going into in these various podcast episodes. Now, various researchers who've looked into the parallels between shamanism and the UFO phenomenon often point out that some of the experiences that people have with so-called aliens seem to mirror initiation ceremonies found in shamanism. Even Jacques Vallée has made this point in some of his books. I'd like to include a quote now, again from this book, Shamanism and Alien Abductions, a Comparative Study. Quote, some UFO researchers, ufologists, claim that being abducted by aliens can be compared with shamanic initiation experiences in traditional societies in that both types of experience may be similarly transformative, leading to a more spiritual or animistic worldview, a deep concern for the environment, and the development of paranormal abilities such as healing. Unquote. Now, in the next section of the book that I want to get into, this person goes into John Mack's history and how he really pioneered a more deep dive into some of the ways that this defies modern conventions about reality. Quoting from the book again, quote, one of the best-known academic researchers in this field and a professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, John Mack asserts that the alien abductees he has studied are not suffering from any known form of mental illness and are therefore probably reporting authentic experiences. Harvard University's negative reaction to Mack's work with abductees perhaps illustrates why there is so little academic research in this field. After the publication of his 1994 book on abductions, amid rumors of his imminent dismissal, the university convened a committee of investigation, which resulted in a letter from the dean saying that I should do my work meeting the standards of the Harvard Medical School. While discussing the meaning of the abduction experiences described in his 1994 book, Mack mentions various spiritual and shamanistic similarities, and in reviewing the UFO literature available up to its publication, he writes, quote, "None of this work, in my view, has come to terms with the profound implications of the abduction phenomenon for the expansion of human consciousness, the opening of perception to realities beyond the manifest physical world, and the necessity of changing our place in the cosmic order if the Earth's living systems are to survive the human onslaught," unquote. Continuing with the book's quote here, quote, "Mack's second book on the abduction phenomenon, Passport to the Cosmos, appears to be the most relevant other research written so far. It pays particular attention to the transformative effects of abduction encounters and goes into more detail about the shamanic connection. In his chapter, Shamans, Symbols, and Archetypes, Mack notes the comparison with shamanic journeys and how many of the images described in abductees' narratives seem to be of archetypal significance. It has long been claimed by ufologists that on occasions, aliens disguise themselves in a variety of ways, perhaps to lessen the trauma to abductees and or perhaps to illustrate the richness and depth of their capacity to communicate. This tendency to indulge in screen imagery, as it is called, could also be seen as a deceptive tactic or as an illustration of the extent to which some abductees are merely projecting their inner concerns onto the situation. Whatever the reason, it certainly makes it difficult to suggest explanations for these events. It may therefore be of assistance to note the apparent similarity between those images reported in shamanism and those seen during abductions, as Mack has done. Specifically, he discusses the symbolism of various types of animals or animal spirits, and quote, symbols of birth, rebirth, death, and transcendence. In the book, Mack also interviews some shamans who themselves claim to have been abducted by aliens. They point out that something akin to the alien abduction experience has been integral to their spiritual traditions for generations, and that they try to regard alien beings as yet another manifestation of the spirit realm. While Mack does not appear to have set out primarily to demonstrate the abduction-shamanism connection, his most recent work shows that such similarities do exist in the experiences of those abductees whom he has interviewed, unquote. And I just want to make sure you caught that there, that not only have these various shamanistic traditions encountered others in other realms, but they too have experienced alien abduction, and that in their tradition, this is just another kind of realm, another dreamscape, if you will, amongst the overarching realityscape. I also think that helps make the point that we shouldn't just reduce the modern UFO phenomenon to shamanistic encounters, nor should we reduce shamanistic encounters to just manifestations of the UFO phenomenon. Really, these are pointing to something more overarching about the nature of reality itself. Longtime listeners of this podcast will by now be very familiar with the research done by the Free Foundation around an experiencer study. And while that is certainly the most expansive and comprehensive of its kind, there were actually other studies that were done previous to this. One of the key ones involved the research of Dr. Ken Ring, and his research is also addressed in this book, and again, some of the contact modality overlap. Specifically, Ken Ring looked into the overlap between near-death experiences and the UFO phenomenon. But again, what we're seeing here is overlap between these various contact modalities. Again, that's the term that Ray Hernandez coined as part of the free research. Quoting now from this book discussing Ken Ring's research, quote, "Another academic who has worked in this field is Ken Ring, a professor of psychology at the University of Connecticut, who discusses the results of his study into the similarities between UFO close encounters and near-death experiences, but also notes their similarity to shamanic experiences. Ring's survey did not specifically set out to investigate the shamanic connection, but does discuss it in some detail. He notes that alien abduction experiences are often recalled as being dreamlike, that they can be frightening, and that they frequently have childhood antecedents, which may result in abductees developing an extended range of human perception beyond normally recognized limits. He also discovered that after their experiences, abductees reported significant psychophysical changes such as increased sensitivity to electromagnetic fields, mood fluctuations, increased information and processing capacity, and the development of various paranormal abilities. Ring devotes a chapter to beliefs and value shifts following extraordinary encounters, noting that his subjects reported significant increases in their appreciation for life, as well as social and ecological matters. They also reported an increased interest in spiritual issues accompanied by a belief that what had happened to them was part of a general expansion or development of human consciousness. In discussing the meaning of these experiences, Ring notes that, quote, abductions may represent a particularly contemporary form of shamanic journey, one that fits and is phrased in terms of a highly technological society that has already turned its imaginative attention to starflight. Ring concludes with the suggestion that the increasing fascination with and immersion in the domain of extraordinary encounters may well presage the shamanizing of modern humanity. Like many other researchers, Ring favors the otherworld theory to explain close encounters and adopts the term the imaginal realm, which was originally proposed by a renowned French Islamic scholar, Henri Corbin, in 1972. Accessible by altered states of consciousness, Ring writes that, quote, not only is the imaginal realm ontologically real, it is also a world that has form, dimension, and most important for us, persons or entities. Ring's otherworld conclusions are of relevance to this research because they closely mirror shamanistic beliefs. However, it must be recalled that his research goal was only to compare alien abductions and near-death experiences. His subject questionnaire, while comprehensive in that it contained questions designed to elicit subjects' religious and spiritual beliefs, did not specifically set out to compare abduction experiences with shamanic ones. Unquote. So clearly thus far in this episode, we've seen demonstrated the remarkable overlap in elements between shamanistic journeys and encounters with supposed aliens as part of the modern UFO phenomenon. So we see much of the data is overlapping. We see parallels everywhere. I think that should be clear by this point. But I also want to bring in one example that speaks to a direct one-to-one relationship between shamanistic encounters or shamanistic ceremonial kind of practices and what people end up encountering afterwards. This speaks to the experience of my good friend Sinead Wellahan, who you may remember I discussed recently on Liminal Frames as someone who had an experience that then synchronistically inspired an experience that I had. Now, what's very interesting about Sinead's experience is that she had no interest in ufology, zero interest in aliens, UFOs, none of that. She was a Buddhist practitioner historically. Now, she went to Peru to take part in an ayahuasca ceremony led by a traditional shaman. So again, she had no interest in UFOs. She went to Peru to have a very authentic experience with a traditional shaman in a traditional culture. Now, as part of the shamanistic journey, some of you may know that you ingest ayahuasca, which is a drink that is made from a plant whose key ingredient, psychoactive ingredient, is DMT. We also know from this podcast that DMT can also induce experience with other kinds of realms and other kinds of beings. Now, the first two times, nothing happened. She hadn't taken enough, apparently. On the third attempt, taking this ayahuasca, she was suddenly taken into a different realm altogether. And to her immediate shock and surprise, she found herself on board a UFO encountering aliens. Aliens that seemed to recognize her and seemed to be thankful that she had found a way to finally reach them. So again, here you have a complete melding of these two different kinds of traditions. You have someone who is trying to use ayahuasca as part of a traditional shamanistic ceremony, and the encounter they had on the other side of that was with aliens aboard a UFO. So here we have what we see as technological craft in our modern society, but encountered through a traditional shamanistic ceremony. So again, this just shows how much our modern conceptions that tends to keep these completely separate is failing to see some overarching aspect about reality by doing so. Clearly, these collapse into some other kind of truth, a truth that is being pointed to by each of these different traditions, whether we're speaking of the modern UFO phenomenon and how that mythos is framed, or the ancient shamanistic one. Sometimes, as in this case with Sinead, you have the two collapsing into one experience in the very same encounter. Now, when we reflect on these revelations that have come forward in this episode, I think the key is to get beyond the sense that what we perceive as our waking state in quote-unquote physical reality is fundamentally different and more substantive than these other realms and or states of consciousness. Conscious experience is conscious experience, full stop. And as part of that conscious experience, we find a variety of interpenetrating dreamscapes, none more real than another, and importantly, ultimately, all part of the same thing, which is to say all expressions of manifestation arising from original mind, of which all of us and all of them, quote-unquote, arise as well, not as afterthoughts, but as fractal impressions of source consciousness itself. Indeed, rediscovering this core truth may be the most fundamental point of this entire enterprise, of revelation expressed in Eastern and Western religions, our ancient and continuing shamanistic traditions, as well as through experiences with the so-called modern UFO phenomenon. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.